Ali, more invitation, I'm very happy. Celine and I are way back, we studied together the master, so it's very nice to visit you here in the perimeter. It's my first time also here, so I'm very excited. And yeah, thank you everyone for being here. I'm going to talk about this simplex formulation, boundaries, and I'm actually going to talk a bit about all things first until we get there. And the first thing I'm going to compare a bit is like, how can we deal with theory in physics? So the two ways that combine what is called the canonical formalism and the covariant formalism. Sorry, we have been talking about that before. So in a nutshell, what is each one? So the canonical formalism is the one that you have your space-time and you break it into space and time kind of thing. So you break all the objects that you have, you take like a foliation or whatever you think, a cushy surface, and you say, well, this is tangent, this is normal, and everything is breaking in that way. The advantages, the covariant space is the one that deals with the field as a whole in space-time without doing this breaking. So in the...
Sorry? Did someone, sorry.
Okay, so I'm gonna go quickly from what I said before. Sorry about that for the people on Zoom. So I was talking about how the canonical we have the canonical formalism and the covariant physics space formalism. In the canonical is the one that we break our objects into spatial and time, or the tangent and normal parts. Meanwhile, in the covariant phase space is the one that we deal with the whole solution without breaking ever what is space and what is time. Now, the advantages of the canonical formalism is that it gives you a dynamical perspective. So you have some objects and you get how they evolve in time, how they change in time. So you get the derivative and you can see how, like this dynamic perspective. You also have some universal structures. So usually you're working in a cotangent bundle, and the cotangent bundle is very nice because it has what is called a symplectic structure. And this is a universal thing that you always have whenever you have a manifold. You can always take the cotangent bundle and you can always build this symplectic structure. Of course, there is a numerical approach, which apparently you're an expert in. You need that. You need to break what is an initial condition and then you evolve that you can do numerically. And of course, for the quantization schemes, as far as we know, well, it depends on the quantization, but some of them you need this polarization, you need to break the position of momentum. For that, you need also to break that. On the downside, you have that there is some sort of apparent loss of symmetry. You're breaking covariance. Space and time are no longer intertwined in this thing. You're breaking, you're choosing one way to break your space-time. Of course, the symmetries are there, but you cannot use it usefully in all these things, or it's harder to make use of them. On the other side, we have, on the other side of the ring, we have the covariant phase space, where the symmetries are explicit because you're not breaking anything. So whatever symmetries you had at the beginning, you will have all the way until the end, and at any point that you want, you can use them. It's easier to study the null infinity, because the null infinity is something about the whole space-time. You cannot just take a Cauchy surface and try to study the null infinity. It's also good to study conserved quantities. And another thing that is good in covariant phase space is because it doesn't distinguish between higher-order theories and first-order theories. They are the same. In the covariant phase space, it doesn't even make much sense to talk about the order, because the order is usually kind of in how many derivatives you have in the time. However, on the downside of that is that there is no canonical structure. Here we have some universal structure and here we don't. So before keep going and saying how we can deal with both sides, let me give you a little recap on, or a crash course in differential geometry. Pretty sure most of you know, so I'm gonna be very brief. So on one side we have the M, this is our space-time, finite dimensional manifold. That we assume that is this kind of, that you can be, it can be broken in this space and time, but we don't do that in principle. And of course, we can always build the tangent space and vectors. we can build the cotangent space and covectors, and we can build in general tensor fields and the tensor bundle and tensor fields. On the other side, we have the space of fields. Space of fields, you can think metrics, you can think scalar fields, you can think whatever you want. But it's an infinite dimensional manifold, which is way more complicated than a finite dimensional manifold. It's not just changing an n or an infinite. It's way more complicated. A lot of theorems are not true any longer in the infinite dimensional. But some of the things that we know from the finite dimensional, they are true. For instance, we can build the tangent space, or we can have tangent vectors. We can build the cotangent and have one forms in the space of fields. And in general, we can have tensor fields. But of course, you cannot use indices because it's infinite dimensional. The indices are only in the finite dimensional. And of course, in this side, we have the useful operators. We have the exterior derivative, we have the interior derivative, we have the lead derivative, and all the operators that you can think of. And this is just differential geometry on M. So of course, we should be able to have something similar here. And actually, you do. There are some things that are a bit tricky, but in general, you have the exterior derivative on F, the interior derivative, and the lead derivative. This, by the way, sometimes denoted with a delta. I prefer this because it's more similar to the other one. But they satisfy the same properties. D squared is equal zero, D sum to commute with another one, the lead derivative and the D commute, all these kind of things that you have in differential geometry, you will have it in this infinite dimensional. Now, let's go. And all these, they combine in what is called the bicomplex framework. You just grab the space and the fields, you mask them together, and there is a formalism called the bicomplex framework. Also, this side I haven't told, but this side, the space of fields, can be treated mathematically in what is called the infinite jet bundle. In case you're interested, that's how you do it, but for us, we can just think that it's a normal manifold, just a bit weird because it's infinite dimensional. Now, let me tell you about the covariant phase space formalism very briefly. First, example. It's always nice to have an example. What is the canonical example? Well, the scalar field. You can see the scalar field. So our space of fields are just every possible field, every possible scalar function here, a smooth function, and the Lagrangian is just the useful scalar Lagrangian, the scalar field Lagrangian. So just kind of the velocity square. So it's kind of a kinetic energy if you want. And this is what is called an N form. I'm working with N forms, not with densities. It's equivalent, but it's better for some reasons to work with N forms, top forms. And the thing is, like, when you have that, the Lagrangian, usually you want to know the equations, so you take variations. And in this context that I showed you before in the geometric differential slide, is you take the exterior derivative. You take this double D, which again, usually you will see as a delta, but in the mathematical literature it's called with a D, sometimes with a vertical D it's called, but it's kind of the same. And you take the variation of that Lagrangian, and because the G is fixed, you only get this twice, the 1/2 goes away. And what you do here, usually when you're treating an action, usually you will take with an integral, you integrate by parts. In here, we don't have an integral, but we can do the same. We can just use Leibniz rule. So we take the derivative out of this term to this term, so we get this plus this. I'm sure you've seen this on time. And then what we can see is that we have some equations of motion start the variation plus something exact. Sometimes you may have seen that it's a divergence term, it's the same. Guys, the equations of motions are actually what is called a source form. Doesn't matter what is the definition of a source form, is what you have in mind for equations of motion. And this term, which if you take an integral, this is a divergence term, so by the Stokes theorem, it goes to zero, is actually very important because it allows us to build, it's just given by this, it's not important, the particular expression, but when you take the exterior derivative, so this double D again, so you get this object, you take out the normal D, and you put a double D, you pick a Cauchy surface, and you integrate, and what you get is this. You take the exterior derivative of this, and you're going to get this. This is like the position. This is like the momenta. So dq wedge dp, this is a symplectic form. Now, it depends on the Cauchy surface that you take, so you have to be careful. But if you go what is called on shell, if you go to the space of solutions, this is actually a symplectic form over here. So that's how you can get a symplectic form, canonically associated with the actually with the action, not only with the Lagrangian but with the action. So in this is the case. Now in general, we can go a bit more general. We take some action that is given like the integral of some Lagrangian. Now the Lagrangian, if you evaluate as some field, now the fields are not a scalar field; they can be whatever. I shouldn't have called phi. It's just any fields. It can be metric, it can be vector fields, it can be tensor fields, it can be whatever you think, any tensor. Actually, any section of any bundle that you can think of. The Lagrangian here is a top form, but actually you can remove these dependence and just work in what is called the bicomplex framework. So you remove these dependence, and now it has, you have to say like this is an N4 on M and a zero form on F. So it's just a scalar you put and it gives you an N4. Now, Gordan theorem, if you take two Lagrangians that they're equal up to an exact form, because you are integrating, the exact form will go away, like the Stokes theorem, the divergence theorem, the Gauss theorem, whatever you want to call, it will go away and the actions are the same. Now, is the converse true? If you can give me two actions that they are equal, two actions that come from two Lagrangians that they are they equal except up to an exact form? And the answer is no. They're not equal. You have to be careful with that. But if the bundle is contractible, then they are equal up to exact form. It's just a little technical thing that you have to be careful because if it's not, if there is some sort of loops, you might have weird contributions. But still, they are not very hard to deal with. They are kind of harmless from a physical perspective. So we can kind of say that, okay, the Lagrangians are defined up to exact forms, are we good? So the spatial solution is actually given by the singular points of the action. That's what we did before. But now it's with the integral, so we just equal zero. And when we take the variation of the action, it's just the variation of the Lagrangian. And what we did before of just removing the covariant derivative, you can kind of always do that. And you can always write the equations of motions and the variation plus something that is exact. Now, this is a theorem. You can always do that. So when you plug this in here, this term will vanish. And what you get is that the equations of motion at zero. So the spatial solution is given by the E equals zero, and then you have the inclusion that this is going to be important over the whole space of fields. What we did before is we take the theta, we remove the D, and we put this double D. And when you, well, that's on the next slide, sorry. What happens if we change now a different Lagrangian? So if we take these two Lagrangians, this L prime equal L plus dy, when you compute this, you actually see that you obtain the same equations of motion. And the only thing that changes is this theta. This is called the symplectic potential, and it will change by this y that is here. But also when you're removing a d, you have to be careful because you're making a choice. You're choosing a representative because you can always add something that is exact because d squared is equal to zero. So here, if you plug this term in here, this last term will vanish. Okay, so this is an ambiguity that we have, and you have to be careful with that ambiguity. However, if we define, given a Cauchy embedding, we define the symplectic or presymplectic form in that way, what we get, we remove the D and we put a double D. We're reducing the degree because we're removing one D, and we're increasing the degree because we're adding a double D. So this is an N minus one, two form. So we can integrate over a sigma because we're integrating instead of M, we go to N minus one. So we pick a Cauchy surface and we integrate that. Now, in the previous slide, I mentioned that there are these ambiguities. What happens if we plug these ambiguities in this definition? Well, if you take that, you just take the definition of this theta prime is equal to theta plus dy plus dz. This d and d is d squared, it's an exact form, it's an exterior derivative, d squared is equal to zero. And now this and this, they actually commute or anti-commute, depends on the formal kind of convention. But this is, I didn't say, but there is no boundary so far. I'm working with no boundary. So this goes to zero. And then we get, So this term vanishes, this term vanishes. It's only true because there is no boundary. Because if there were a boundary, we would have a contribution on the boundary from this seed. Okay? So if there is no boundary, we're good. It only depends on the embedding, as I mentioned before. But if you go on shell, you take the pullback, the space of solutions, we have a symplectic form, or it can be degenerate, so some should be better called pre-symplectic form, canonically associated with the action defined over the space of solution. So that's the covariant phase space. It's very important for if you're studying thermodynamics of black holes, or you're studying conserved quantities, charges, and all that. This is very important. That is what you need. Now, before going to the boundaries, let me tell you about the canonical formalism. I'm going to go even faster than the previous example. In the canonical formalism, we have break all our fields. You have a metric, and then you break it into a three metric, the lapse and the shift. If you have a vector field, you take the tangent part, and you take the normal part. So you break everything, and then you gather your new fields in this cube. And usually you have what is called, I call it like the Pan Lagrangian action. It's just the usual Lagrangian that you have. Like, just take something. It works like an action, but it's not exactly an action because you haven't integrated in time. That's why sometimes it's called Lagrangian, sometimes it's called action, sometimes it's called density Lagrangian. There are like different names, but I call it like that. And the thing is, like, once you're here, you're working in the Lagrangian. So you have positions and velocities. And we mentioned that we have some universal structures. The universal structures are actually in the Hamiltonian side. We have to go to the cotangent bundle. However, when you do, you go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian, you don't reach all the position or all the momenta. There might be some constraints. So usually you go to what is called the primary constraints manifold. Okay? If you do the Legendre transformation, it might not be invertible. So some of the momenta are not available. So that's why, although you have a canonical structure here, you're not interested in that one. You're interested in here. So what you have to do is actually you have the usual over the cotangent bundle, which is just position and momenta, dq wedge dp. Just like in mechanics, this is field theory, but still it works in the same way. You have to take the pullback through this embedding, and then you get this canonical symplectic structure. It's called canonical. It's a bit confusing because it's not canonical in the sense that it's given. This one is canonical. This one, although it's called canonical because of the canonical formalism, is not canonical. It depends on the Lagrangian. If I change the Lagrangian, this will change because this primary constraint manifold would change. But that's good because actually we proved a few months away back that if you get any theory of any order such that a canonical formalism exists, so you can go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian, if that is true, then these two constructions that I showed you previously, they are the same, which is good. Because otherwise, you're taking two different paths. You're going like, I can break at the beginning, work everything and get a symplectic form, or I can say, no, I don't want to break anything, and I'm going to get a symplectic form. And it's the same, if you quantize this theory and you quantize this theory, or if you do numerics here and numerics in that, is it the same or not? Well, in this symplectic part, at least, they are exactly the same. Now, this was known for some specific cases. It was known with no boundary and for first order theories, but in general, it was not known. Now, what happens when we add boundaries? This is the interesting part, I think, I hope. Adding boundaries is very complicated in general. Boundaries behave way differently. If, I don't know if you ever thought about that, but boundaries actually, there is a discontinuity. If you measure the dimension and you're moving smoothly to the boundary, the dimension will drop by one. And that's a discontinuity. That's something that really is a sudden change. And in mathematics, we're not very keen of those kind of things. So you have to be careful with boundaries. Boundaries, they really behave badly in some sense. Now, let's assume that you get your boundary and you get just a piece of your boundary. Doesn't have to be. So the canonical example that you can have in your mind is like, get a cylinder. So you have the bottom lid, you have the top lid, and you have the kind of the lateral side. So we can think that N is just this lateral boundary. So it's going to be interval times the boundary of sigma. So this is sigma. this is the boundary of sigma. I ran out of colors. So this is going to be the boundary. So I'm just taking kind of the lateral thing, okay? So that's N, the whole boundary is with the lid, and the whole manifold is the solid cylinder. Now you can have what is called the relative forms. They are just considered pairs that are R forms on N and 1 degree less on N. Okay, that's because I want to. I'm gonna define pairs that you have to give me a form of 1 degree in the bulk and 1 degree less on the band. Now, this is on a book by Body 2. I don't know if you heard about that book. It's called Algebraic Topology on Differential Manifold or something like that. I don't know, I remember. But they described that. I was studying all these covariant phase space, blah, blah, blah. And then I ran into that book and they defined this, what is called the relative cohomology. You ever heard of that? Good, if not, not important. The relative cohomology, they mentioned that, they define this and they define this, and they say, oh, D squared is equal zero, so you can do cohomology. That's how cohomology works. If you have an operation that increases the degree, and when you go twice, it goes to zero, you can do cohomology. If you have a map that takes you 1 degree less and the square is zero, you can do homology. You don't need anything else from a mathematical perspective. So this satisfies that, and they don't mention absolutely anything else. But I was pretty excited when I saw that, because this is exactly what I was needed, what I thought it was missing in this covariant phase space with boundaries. Why? Because, well, first of all, I tried to, what are the other operations that you can have? I put this underline, because I'm taking the exterior derivative. Obviously here, well, I didn't say, but of course, if you get something of degree R, this is gonna be degree R plus one, and this is gonna be R minus one, this is gonna be of degree R, and this is gonna be R minus one plus one, so it's degree R. So this is well-defined, it goes from R to R plus one. Why this particular sign and why this particular order, we will see in a moment. The thing is, like, once you have that, I needed the other operations. What is the wedge? I don't know. What is the interior product? I don't know. But I wanted to know, so I looked for everywhere. It was not every, and I don't know, I'm sure someone has done that before because it's very easy. Just do some computation. But actually, you can just figure out. You take two objects of those, you take the wedge, not important what is the particular expression that you can just think of. Is you kind of impose that the Leibniz rule is satisfied or some sort of rules are satisfied, and you get the expression. Not only that, you can also think, what is the integral? If you get a top form, something that has degree n, like this, degree n on m and degree b, n minus one on m, which is one, has one like less dimension. Well, I didn't mention, but this is the, has to be of the same dimension. You just take the integral of this minus the integral of this. A minus is just a convention, doesn't matter. I mean, you have to be careful that you choose always the same kind of convention. So this is the integral of this pair. Once you have that, on my own question is like, well, what happens if I take something that is exact and I integrate that? If you have no boundary, the integral of something that is exact is zero. What is, or if you have boundary in general, you will have something like this. If you want to pull the pullback, you kind of take this D, this D goes to this delta. They are dual to each other. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but you also kind of, sometimes it's written like this. I don't know if the camera, yeah, I guess they're following me, that's nice. Okay. Something like this. The pair of M with the alpha is the same, the pair of alpha with this delta. So you can think that this is jumping here. They are adjoined in some sense. So what do we have here? Well, first we have the definition of the D with the underline, and then we just integrate. So we integrate this over M and this over M. So we did this, perfect. Now this, we have this theorem that whenever you have the integral of something, you can go to the boundary. So this term on red, this goes to the boundary. So you have to integrate this over M, but then you subtract this over N. This is something that is bigger than this. You're integrating something over a manifold, and then you subtract this. So you're just integrating on the complementary. So this term is just the integral of this object on the complementary of the boundary. So in this case, on the leads, you're integrating only over the leads. Now this term is the same. You can go to the boundary. So this term is the integral over the boundary of N. And now this, we can use the definition of the integral, and we just put the whole pair. So now, if this object, you define it like that, you get that they are dual to each other. So this is telling you that this is the right definition of the relative boundary, which makes sense because you're kind of taking the dual. Here goes to here, and this minus is kind of this minus, and kind of thing. I mean, it makes sense. It's not completely absurd to think that this will work. Actually, obviously, by this computation, it works. So this term, you just put in the relative boundary, and just to be a bit nicer, you can also define just the pullback as the pullback of this and the pullback of this. But when you merge that, what you get, the first term and the last one, you get this, which is remarkably similar to this. It's exactly the same. So whenever you have, this goes up and down. So here in this case, you will have something like MN. I put it the other order, sorry. So D alpha beta MN is equal alpha beta MN. So formally, they're exactly the same. So this is the relative Stokes theorem. And well, of course, I'm not gonna put it explicitly, but we also figure out what are the right definitions that you have to put in here. So that absolutely every rule that you have on M, you have it also on this pair. So now, that I mentioned before, D squared is equal zero, you can do cohomology and it's called relative cohomology. And because the boundary, the relative boundary is empty, you can check. So two steps computation, you can do homology and it's called relative homology. Now, with these three ingredients, you're good to go. Because once you're here, nothing prevents you to call this A, you call this, Z, and then you call this A, and you call this Z. So the property that you have, dA Z equals A delta Z. So now you can see that it's exactly the same. You don't care what are these objects A and Z. Formally, all the computations are exactly the same. It doesn't matter that they appear because they behave like one entity with all these properties. So what we have proved is that actually MN behaves as a manifold with boundary. And in particular, the definition of the boundary was MN N. So what happens when you take N to be the whole boundary? Well, you get partial M minus partial M, partial square of M, and this is actually empty. So a manifold with its boundary behaves in this cohomological setting as a manifold without boundary. So everything that is cohomological, absolutely everything that you do without boundary that is cohomological is going to translate immediately with boundary using this formalism. And well, of course, this is what is called the relatively complex framework. You just merge them, okay? How does this translate into our formalism? How can we go to the covariant phase space formalism with boundary? Well, before we had a Lagrangian that it was a top form and you integrated over the manifold to get an action. That's nice. Whenever you have an object, you put a pair, and whenever you have an operator, you put the relative operator. So you kind of put the down, and well, you have to change, I didn't put it, but when I put the integral, MN, you can think like there is an underline. We were thinking about putting the underline, but it was like too cumbersome, but it's like the integral is also the relative version. So everything just changed. So in this case, instead of one Lagrangian, you have a pair of Lagrangians, and instead of the integral, you have the relative version of the integral. And here, instead of one Lagrangian, you have a pair that is a top four. And this, remember, the definition of this is the this belongs to this, and this belongs to this, and there is 1 degree of difference. So here is the integral of L over M minus the integral of little l over the band. Of course, it can be zero, but it might not be. Now, before we had that if two Lagrangians are equal up to exact form, the actions are the same because you integrate, and by the Stokes theorem, the exact form goes away. Now, when we put a pair equals a pair plus a relative exact form, because the relative Stokes theorem, this goes away. So this is equal to this, and the actions are the same. Is the opposite true? Yes, if you have contractible bundles. Before we had, if two actions are the same, given by two different Lagrangians, they are equal up to they are equal in cohomology, they are equal up to exact form. In the relative version, you just put pairs everywhere, and instead of a D, you have a D and a line. And now the space of solution is just given by the same, the singular points of the action. And once we were here, we said, okay, you take the variation of this, this is the variation of this, and this is this. So what one might think is like, well, I put an underline here, instead of one object, I have two, and instead of one object, I have two, and a D underline. But, and this is very important, but this result I told you before, this is a theorem. You can prove that this is always true. But this proof is not cohomological. This is an analytical proof. You need to prove using analytical tools, not cohomological tools. So this does not translate well to the relative, which makes sense. Because you have to be careful with the boundary conditions. Laurent here knows a lot about that. Of the boundary conditions, you have to be careful, right? So here, what you can get is like, okay, I'm gonna take the variation of S, I'm gonna take the variation of here, the underline here in the, everything double is just component wise. So it's the delta of this and the delta of that, or double D is here. So when you do that, so you have the S equals DL minus D little L over M over the boundary of M. And now we have the theorem that this is true. This is all true. This is a theorem that tells us that. So you plug that information in here and you get E D phi plus D theta, then minus DL. And this is over M. And now by our Stokes theorem that is over there, this goes to the boundary. So what you get, equations of motions times some variation minus the integral of DL minus the pullback of theta. So you get this. And the only thing that we're gonna do is like, well, we're gonna assume that this is true, that we can break this object into this and this. Now, this is not a theorem. If you choose wrong, if you choose a bad L, little l, this is not gonna be a good variational principle. If you think of GR, you get L to be Einstein-Hilbert and you put L, little l equals zero. When you do this, you're gonna get some variation like in the normal directions. And that's not good. What do you need? You need the Hawking-Gibbons-York term. You need an additional term such that this is true. So in general, you don't have that, but through physical reasoning, you can choose the right L, or you can choose the right F. That's another option. You can constrain your F, that is nowhere to be found here. You can constrain your F such that this is true. So in a sense, whatever term that is bad, that is not of this form, you have to think how to kill it, either choosing a different L or choosing a different F. Question?
Yeah, sorry. So can you see how the first variation of the action that is not zero, but the eigenvalue you can have some zero? Because I know when you have some leaks, I don't expect to have a well-defined version principle. I might be just like confused whether or not that implies a well-defined version principle or not.
So what I'm saying is like I'm following the variational principle. So I'm looking for singular points of the action, and I don't care how the action is defined. If it has boundary terms or not, I don't care. I'm looking for singular points. Okay, I'm going in the straight path. You might argue that this is not the right path, but the path of saying like, I'm gonna define the space of solutions associated with the action as the singular points of the action. Okay, so now you have to take the variation of the action, and the variation of the action is given by this, like this. This I can write like this, so I get to this point. And I know that this is zero if and only if E is zero, and this whole thing is zero.
Yeah, but sometimes I don't want to have that the boundary term to be zero. Sometimes I want to keep it if an action is
E. Yeah, but then you're not following the variational principle.
Okay, you do. Okay.
Yeah, because I'm defining the solutions of an action to be the singular point.
Okay.
If you don't want to define the space of solution, or you, yeah, that's absolutely your choice. But what I'm doing is, like, naively, I'm going to take whatever definition I have without boundary, and I'm going to extend with boundary. Of course, there are different ways to do that. But this is kind of the cohomological one. It's like, I'm just going to stick to the cohomology, and whatever I did before, I'm going to do it, but in the relative version. So here, you just put this, and of course, this is actually just a necessary, sufficient condition. So this is not necessary. You can have that to be zero without this to be equal to this. But this is just like a simple thing to ask. And in particular examples, you can give me like a weird example, and still this is not of this form, but it still is zero for whatever reason. Okay? Did I answer your question? Good, nice. Perfect. So now we can write, if this is true, we can write this in this fashion, which is just the relative version of this one. So instead of one theta, we have two. Instead of equations of motions, we have equations of motion and kind of equations of motion at the boundary. They're usually called boundary equations, boundary conditions, sorry. And you have two Lagrangians. So we have exactly the same equation. But again, theorem, not a theorem. You have to impose that. But once we have that object, we can ask, well, what happens if I take two of those? Two different Lagrangians. The space of solutions is given by E and B equals zero. And given a Cauchy embedding, I should have put it. What happens if you take a different one? Well, the theta is going to change in the same way, and the small theta is going to change also in the same way. Now, this is the part where I don't need to do any computations, because all the computations that I did before were cohomological. This is the only thing that is not cohomological. All the rest, it is. So the fact that if I go here, I just have to change this for this, the relative version. So instead of one Cauchy surface, I take the Cauchy surface with its boundary. Instead of one symplectic potential, I have the bulk symplectic potential and the boundary symplectic potential. I take the zero derivative and then I integrate, blah, blah, blah. Now, if you expand that, you're going to write this plus this. So there is a contribution, a boundary contribution that is necessary for this to be well defined. In what sense? Well, if you take B, a different choice, I didn't write that. Anyway, before, remember, the theta was defined up to exact form with normal D and with double D. So before I had theta prime is equal theta plus some dy plus some dz. So equal up to exact form in the M and exact form on F. So here, the only thing I have to do is just put by pairs. So I put prime prime. Actually, I think it, yeah, I have it here. So here, the prime prime is going to be here plus something exact in the vertical direction and in the fields, and something exact on M. Exactly the same formula, just changing one object for two objects and every operator by the relative version of the operator. And I don't need to prove absolutely anything. This is absolutely true, because you can just call these A, you can call these B, C. It doesn't matter that they are pairs. They just behave as one object. So of course, you have a well-defined symplectic structure. Except it depends on the Cauchy embedding. So you have to go to the space of solution. But this, once you go on shell, this is canonically associated with the action. You give me an action, and you can take two Lagrangians, you can take two Lagrangians, you can take two Lagrangians, you can take two Lagrangians. With these two Lagrangians, you can do all these computations here. You do that, and then you're going to choose one theta and one theta. And they're going to be different. They're all of them going to be of this form. All our choices that we have made are related by this formula. So the n, we're going to all end up with the same symplectic structure. And not only that, it will also be the same as the canonical. Now, the canonical approach, you have a cotangent bundle, it doesn't occur if you have boundary or not. It does not. The cotangent bundle is the same. It's defined in the same fashion. You have Qs, you have Ps, it's exactly the same. The primary constraint manifold is a bit more complicated when you have boundaries to compute in practice, and in theory it's just the same. And what we prove that they are actually the same also with boundaries and also for higher order theories. For higher order theory, you have to be a bit careful because the tangent and the cotangent bundle are a bit weird, but still. So, nice, I have some time. So I have some conclusions, and then I had one example. I think I will have time for the example. But so far what I've shown is that we have developed a new formalism, this relative formalism. I mean, we merged different formalisms that were already there, but we just merged them and used it in this coefficient space to define a presymplectic form canonically associated with the action. Now, the bicomplex formalism is absolutely essential. You need to use this kind of F and M in a proper way. We have proved that they are equivalent to the canonical approach, that it was not known. It's also true for higher order theories, but as I mentioned, it's a bit tricky because the tangent and the cotangent bundles are more complicated. And it's also true with boundaries. And we have successfully applied to several theories of gravity, which has solved some open questions. So I have time, right? Nice. So let me tell you how we can apply it to GR. GR is kind of well known for everyone. So we're going to take the Einstein-Hilbert action. So we get the scalar, the Ricci scalar times the volume. And on the other side, this is the Gibbons, Hawking, and Jordan. That's the one that you have to put so that the variational principle is well defined. You take the variation of that side, and you have to write it like this. You remove the covariant derivatives of the variation, and what you're going to find, as we all know, Einstein's equations on one side and the symplectic potential on the other. It's not important what is the form. I put it here in red just in case you want to see how it looks, but it's not important. It's just an expression. Nice. What else? Now you have to go to the bundle. You take the variation of this minus this term or this term, and then you can see that you can write like this. You don't put this, this is not true. That's why you need the Hawking-Gibbons term. Hawking, no, Gibbons, Hawking, and Jordan term. Because otherwise, this is not true. When you do, you find this term minus this. This is telling you that the extrinsic curvature has to be zero. And this is just a boundary term, a boundary symplectic potential that appears. But again, not important what form is it. Now, at this point, I should mention, you have to tell me what is your F, your space of fields. If you just consider metrics, arbitrary metrics, well, not completely arbitrary, you have to say that they are Lorentzian and that the boundary, well, I didn't say, but the boundaries are time-like. I'm just considering time-like boundaries. So the boundary is time-like. You could also tell me, no, I want the space of fields such that the boundary is fixed. I put a metric, so this is like boundary conditions. I put a metric there. I want my theory to be whatever. To have some, then this term, because the metric is fixed in the boundary, this term that it lives in the boundary, this is zero. Okay? So that's why it's important to tell me what is the space of fields. If the space of fields I'm constrained, then this is true. Otherwise, this does not appear and this does not appear. But it's good because we know that the metric is fixed. If the metric is fixed and then you tell me that it also has to satisfy that, it's usually overposed and it's not well-defined theory. But you're gonna have either Dirichlet and this is zero, or this is not zero, and then this is forced to be zero. So these are like Neumann boundary conditions. And of course, you could put any other boundary condition. But here I'm just considering that there is some constraint. So I have this and I have this. And well, one of the questions was that if this theory was equivalent in the covariant phase space to the tetraformalism. Tetraformalism, what is it? I'm sure that most of you know, but it's just, you just take tetrads. They are, you can think of vectors or one-forms, and they sort of build your frames in every point, and in such a way that they have this kind of internal index, Lorentz index, and when you kind of square, it gives you the metric. So given a tetrad, you square it, kind of, and you get a metric. But of course, this is almost a change of variables. you're changing variables from tetras to metric, but of course it's not invertible. So you can have different tetras given rise to the same metric, but good enough, they're just related by a Lorentz transformation point-wise. Okay, so two, they're almost the same. There is like this kind of gauge freedom, so you can rotate your frame and it will give rise to the same metric. But once you have that, you have this change of variable, you're gonna define the tetrad Lagrangians, yes, in the usual way. Give me a tetrad, transform it into a metric, and plug it into the metric version, into the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, tetrad, transform it, plug. Perfect. You do the same with the boundary. You grab the Hawkins-Gibbons, Gibbons, Hawking and George, whatever. I don't know. And then you get a tetrad, you go to a metric, and you plug it into the this term. And what you do, what you find, is this famous R, F, wedge E, wedge E, with the epsilon, and then you get this at the boundary. This is the curvature of the one form, the Levi-Civita or the spin connection. And then you have this, this is the normal, the vector field normal to the boundary. And this is kind of doing the change, the isomorphism to between the space of these indexes and this. You can think that the frames are isomorphies between tangent space and this Lorentz space. Again, not important. What are the particular expressions? It doesn't matter. Probably you have seen this. Maybe you haven't seen that one. But the thing is, like, you can now compute variations. When you compute variations, you have to write it like this. Again, in the bulk, you can always do that. So you do that, and you find Einstein's equations in this tetrad form, and you find the symplectic potential. And you go to the boundary, you do that, and well, actually, the boundary, I didn't want to put it because it's a bit long and messy and it's not much important. And here you get this. Another question is like, if the theories are symplectically equivalent or not. And before, some people would argue that they were not, because different choices will lead. So you define your symplectic form as this, and someone else is a theta prime, then what you get, this is theta plus dy plus dz. D squared is equal zero, so this goes away, but this term goes to the boundary. So you will get that this gamma prime, sorry, is gamma plus the integral over the boundary of this dz. So it's not canonical, there is a choice. And what is the problem? Like if you do the choice in the metric and you do a different choice in the tetrad, they will not match. However, if you consider with the boundary terms, they of course match. And the way, oh well, here I have just, well, first you have to compare the space of solutions, but that's kind of trivial. When you have the action is just with a change of variables. So you take the singular points of these, and this, because this is actually surjective, it's not a change of variable, but almost is good enough. Whatever is zero here is also zero here and the opposite. But you have that the space of solutions are related. So you have a metric that satisfies the Einstein's equations. Every tetrad that gives rise to this metric will satisfy the tetrad Einstein's equations. And conversely, you give me a tetrad that satisfies the tetrad Einstein's equations, its metric will satisfy the normal Einstein's equations. So they are related. The space of solutions are the same. That's good. Otherwise, we are comparing different things. And then what you can prove is that the theta in the metric version is equal to the tetrad plus something exact. So when there is no boundary, that's good because you integrate and this disappears. However, when there is boundary, you will have a mismatch. What is it? Catch that when you compare this small theta, they're actually equal up to this term. Now you gather all these two terms, and what you see is like the metric ones are equal to tetrad ones plus something that is relatively exact. So when you integrate here, and you integrate here, you get that this is equal to this plus zero. And well, this is actually the proper way to write it because you're gonna have to put the change of variable somewhere, but it's kind of like the same. So the tetrad GR is exactly the same as the metric GR in the covariance space. They're exactly equal even when there is boundary. And just to finish with some conclusions of this part, we have proven the CPS equivalence of the metric, GR and Petra GR. And not only that, we have also proven for Paratini and for Holst. You know what is Holst? Good. If not, not important. And we actually proved that all these six theories are actually equivalent up to some gauge terms. Because when I say here that they are equivalent, there is actually here, there is this has some kernel. If you're making a rotation, this goes to zero. So there is a gauge freedom here that, of course, you don't have it here. But this is taking care of all this term. That's why you need kind of this. But what I'm telling is like every rotation is actually gauge, because this doesn't see any gauge, so this cannot see any gauge. So everything has to go zero. So the same is with the, when you go to Palatini to Tetra, there is also like a gauge freedom, and with the holes is exactly the same. The problem is cohomological, so, and I hope that's, you take one thing at home on my talk, is that these problems are cohomological. And if they're cohomological, you need cohomological solutions. Or, well, you don't need them, but you might, with cohomological solutions, you don't need to think about representatives because they don't depend. The cohomologies depend, is defined up to representatives. So everything makes sense if you define in terms of cohomology. Now, the Lagrangian boundary terms are essential. And that is the, for instance, the Gibbons-Hawking-Yorke term. You need it. If you don't put it, the theory is not well defined, and you have weird things happening at the boundary. Now, these symplectic boundary terms are also required. Otherwise, you will get something like this. It will change. You need to put the small theta in your theory to have a well-defined cohomological symplectic form. Of course, I didn't say that, but you can have this and then tell me how you're choosing your representative. That's another option. You can say, oh, whenever I have this, I'm going to choose the representative that satisfies this condition. That's another option. But I'm always giving you a way to do that without having to choose absolutely anything. That's a path that I'm paving for you. You want to take it? Good. You don't want to take it? Also good. You might take a different one, and it might be as good or even better. I don't know. But in this framework, you need the symplectic boundary term. And that's all. Thank you so much. We have the paper where we did the CPS with boundaries, the one that we proved equivalence, and this is just GR, Palatini, and Holst. And that's all. Thank you so much. Nice, thank you. Thank you to some people.
Yeah. let me just start my question. So, I agree with you, like, at the end of the day, you can choose to go to the way of the structure, but when you come to the challenges that you need to do, and this part of the truth may not be very important. So, you have a bit of a decision about, what is going to happen.
Well, the charges are always the same. No, no. Well, that's a consequence. I choose the boundary terms in such a way that the theories are the same, that the space of solutions are the same. And once the space of solution are the same, this is a consequence. This is always true. So once you choose, if you choose a different boundary Lagrangians in tetras than in metric, and you don't make them match, the space of solutions is different.
Okay.
So the fact that the charges are different is not surprising. It's like, yeah, you're comparing two different theories, so the charges might be different. But yeah, yeah. In all this, we also proved that the charges are the same in both formalism. Well, some charges, not all of them, but the usual ones.
Yeah. Question from Zoom or
Simple question. Is there any, the reason why you use standard boundaries is just because it's easier because you want to your term than the null boundary term, or is there any people there to be for someone?
That's a very good question, very annoying question. that's a very good question. I think this formalism works for time-like boundaries, the problem with null boundaries is that they are intrinsically very different from time-like boundaries. And what I would say, like, null boundaries behave more like space-like boundaries in this formalism. Because in particular, you can put Cauchy data in the null surfaces in certain theories. You can, and that doesn't fit well with having boundary conditions. If you're able to specify Cauchy data, that means that kind of you can put whatever you want. And if you can put that, you cannot have boundary conditions. Or boundary conditions are constraints on your Cauchy data kind of intertwined. So it's very, very complicated. And I think a lot about that. My take is that with null boundaries in the compact, in the non-asymptotically case, is you cannot fit this formalism in that.
Yeah, I think.
I'm sorry, that's been done.
Huh? But not in a cohomological way. You have to do some choices.
Where is the variation?
Well,
I think
the
point. We know how to do it. And then recently, so there's a generalization.
But you need to do some choices and tell me how you're choosing your theta. Otherwise, it's not cohomological.
Same thing, it's just the intensive data. So, I mean, there is, it has been done.
But in the asymptotic case or in the
finite case, can show you that I can give you the right.
But you need to, it's not cohomological. You need.
Yes, no, it is. It's just.
I don't know.
You can fit it in your framework if you want, but yeah, it is completely under control.
Yeah, but being under control is not like there are some choices that you have to make.
Well, same thing as yours. You're fixing the metric of the boundaries.
So no, I'm not. I'm not making any choices. Here you can do.
Here you're making a choice of what is your boundary condition. You're making your choice that you're in my feedback actually is the key is the index metric. So once you make the choice, there are no mistakes. Same thing for the null case. Once you decide the notion of intrinsic geometry in the null case, once you fix it, there's a unique boundary action.
Yeah, but I can show it to you, which is I would like to say that, but I don't know. I mean, I've.
But
yes, people have
but I think in the new case, what's very different on the time like case is that you cannot escape flux. I mean, you will have flux, I mean, except if you just have the cross case.
But then you put a boundary condition, which is the flux.
Yeah, but I don't want to think that the timeline makes.
Yeah, but the problem with, for me, what a boundary kind of tells you how the information reflects in interior, right? So you have some boundaries and it's how things are going back to the interior. And the null case, it doesn't go back to the interior, it just stays in the null case. Yeah, but it's a very, for instance, you cannot do a cotangent formalism in the null case. If you put Cauchy data on the null case, there is no cotangent bundle that you can use.
There is.
No, yeah. Because if you have.
Sorry, the papers are out, so don't let me know.
We can work out the scalar field. But if you put in the scalar field, just in the scalar field, and you put information in the boundary, if you provide the information just of the position, this is well defined. You don't need velocities.
Sure,
see. That's not a cotangent bundle.
Yeah. There's a collection of work on that.
But if you're working on the,
so the generalization of your explicit curvature concept by indeed from that patterns, and there's a generalization of the form you were writing.
Yeah, but in this case, if you put some data here, f0 of x, I'm writing it the mathematical way. If you specify the data here, this is propagated everywhere. And well, you need, and here.
Something for a finite
number. No, because here I only need the position. This I only need the position.
I'm talking about the null surface, just a
minute. That's.
I'm not talking about two boundaries, just talking
about one null surface. Like here? It has to be infinity, up to infinity.
It's a lot more, like, you know. But you can fix the condition locally.
Okay, but
so you can take a portion with your relative cohomology where the boundary is itself a boundary.
then you know exactly what.
But not in the null case. If you take space, like yes. If you think no, the thing is like, imagine this case.
Let me show you. Yeah. It's like you don't have a dynamic boundary to extend to infinity. It could be a portion as you assigned in your first drawing. You have a portion of a cylinder with a cap and a cup. Okay.
Oh, we can work it out there.
Same thing. Yes.
Yeah, just if there's someone else has a question before we ask the official question.
Thanks so much.